Boy, I can tell you, you have a day when you don't have live music, and you really appreciate, you really notice, and you appreciate it. And Phil learned today something that some of us song leaders learned 20, 30, maybe 40 years ago, however long it's been, and that's don't ever try to sing something that the accompanist doesn't know. sometimes we try that in the past, you know, and poor piano players just trying their best, and they don't know the song, and they're not going to learn it while you're up there trying to lead it either. It takes a while. We do appreciate the live music when we get it, and we miss Rick's trumpet as well. So pray for a speedy recovery there. By the way, another thing that doesn't have to do with the sermon, I'm listening to Tammy read about all the people coming out to accompany David back to Jerusalem. It says they came all the way out to the Jordan, and that's a long way from Jerusalem. It's a good walk. But it's an interesting word picture there. And, you know, the scriptures that sometimes are used by people to think there's going to be this rapture in the future, you know, that really that has to do with there's a king coming back to earth, and people are going to come and, you know, we're going to escort him. We're going to escort him back in, just like going out to the Jordan and bring him back to Jerusalem. That's the picture. And I hadn't realized it before, but that picture, you know, may have had its the image may have come right there from David. All right, we have some visitors today, so I was going to recap anyway. I've been giving a series, which was going to be four, but since last week was canceled, it's reduced to three. And this is the third part. If you like titles, well, I won't tell you the title yet. We started in Matthew 22, and in Matthew 22, and you could read it in Luke as well, but I'll read it. I'd read it from Matthew, and I'll do it again. And verse 35, it says, one of them is talking about one of the Pharisees was a lawyer. You know, somebody who, that doesn't mean somebody that goes to court. It means somebody who was a student of the law, knew the law inside and out. Asked him a question, tempting him and saying, Master, which is the great commandment of the law? And Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. I'll interrupt myself again. That word hang right there, I told you before, it means just what it says. In the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, when in the Septuagint there in 2 Samuel 19 or 20, wherever it was, where Tammy was reading about Absalom hanging by his hair, that's the same word. That's the word that's used there in the Greek to translate that from the Hebrew. So Jesus was asked a question. Jesus answered it. He said, love God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. That's all your desire, all your motivation, with all our lives, with 100% of what we have, and all the effort that we can muster. And we also covered in that particular sermon in the first part that to love God is to obey him, and that's made clear throughout the scriptures, both Old and New Testament. We covered a lot of them. And then the second part, the second sermon, we went into the second part of Jesus' answer. The first part was love God with all your heart, soul, and might. The second part was to love your neighbor as yourself. That was quoted from Leviticus 19, verse 18, the loving God with all your heart, soul, and might, quoted from Deuteronomy 6. And then we went through that scripture in Leviticus. We also saw how that was specifically targeted to loving your fellow Israelites. But when you read the prophets in the Old Testament, when you read the New Testament, you get it all together, you find out that God intends for us to love everyone, extended the concept to all of mankind. And we learned that that meant don't seek vengeance, don't repay evil for eat with evil. Loving fellow man is also obeying God's laws. So we talked about that. And, you know, it's the golden rule to treat others as you would like to be treated. And it requires humility. So that's some of the things we covered in the second sermon. Now, I didn't point this out, but I've got one of my favorite authors here. I told you I talked to him, had dinner with him one time, Klein Snodgrass. And this is just, if you ever want to buy a book on the parables, this is the book, Stories with Intent. He worked on this for years. It's a really good book. And he points out that, and he's got the references to prove it, which I didn't look up. I'm going to take his word for it, that Jesus wasn't the first. Nor was the only. He wasn't the only, and he wasn't the first to point out that the obligation of a follower of God was to love God with all your heart, soul, and might, and to love your neighbor as yourself. To put those two concepts together and say that the whole law hung on them, that wasn't a unique concept to Jesus. He was quoting something that other, or putting together concepts that had been put together before him and after him. So there's nothing unique there. It was understood, but as Jesus pointed out, and as you read through the whole New Testament, it wasn't practiced. It was understood, but not practiced. Now, I'm going to read the version from Luke, because we go to Luke chapter 10. And we find the same situation being retold by Luke. And in Luke chapter 10 and verse 25. And it talks about the certain lawyer asking, "What shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus gave him the answer. He said, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You've answered right." In this case, Jesus asked, he asked him a question back. We'll talk about that in a minute. But then it says in verse 29, he, willing to justify himself, said unto Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Ah, so this individual, for whatever his reasons, was looking for an escape clause. All right, I didn't have to love my neighbor. I know that. We all know that. Who's my neighbor? Aha. Maybe he thought, we don't know. We don't know what he was thinking. We can guess. Did he think he was going to get Jesus? Did he think he was going to get out of, an obligation that perhaps was there? There was a tradition in that culture, and those of you that hear me know that I like to bring out cultural things all the time. There was a tradition. If you went to a rabbi and asked him his opinion, you were, by implication that you valued him enough to ask his opinion or his outlook, you were acknowledging that you would follow what he said. It's kind of like if you didn't want to follow what he said, you wouldn't ask him in the first place. So this, at least there's the implication here, he might lose a little face if he didn't follow it, that he was going to accept the answer that he got from Jesus. And when he got the answer to love God with all your heart, soul, and might, love your neighbor as yourself, maybe he wasn't quite happy with that, we don't know, but he wanted to get more detail, he wanted to qualify a little bit. Well, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? So Jesus then begins to answer this question. And I didn't point this out before, but what's interesting about the way Luke puts it together, and I never noticed this before, I read it in a commentary, I'm sorry, I don't remember which one it was, so I can't give credit, but I never noticed it. Jesus had given he had tied together two things that had been tied together before. Love God with all your heart, soul, and might, love your neighbor as yourself. And then he tells the story about the Good Samaritan that we're going to talk about today, and he says, that is the explanation for how you love your neighbor as yourself. What I never noticed before is that what comes right after that, in verse 38, it came to pass as they went that he entered into a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha received him into her house, and she had a sister called Mary. So this is Mary and Martha. We all know the story, right? Mary sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word, but Martha was cumbered about with much serving and came to him and said, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do all this serving? Go tell her to come help me." And Jesus answered, said, "Martha, Martha, you're worried about a lot of things and troubled. I understand, but one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her." Do you see what I see? What I see now, after it was pointed out to me? Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan talks about how to love your neighbor as yourself. The story of Mary and Martha, Luke puts right there, because it answers the question, love God with all your heart, soul, and might. Martha was busy serving, and she could say that's loving God, serving neighbor, and all that. But Mary was complimented for wanting what was important. So that ties in with the loving God with all your heart, soul, and might. So never noticed that before. I just thought it was interesting. So I mentioned this one resource. This is an excellent book, Stories with Intent. It goes through, I didn't count them, but pretty much everything that Jesus gave in terms of stories and parables. The other resource I use quite a bit for this sermon, and I'm going to be quoting from it a lot, and I've used him before, is Doug Greenwald, which is his ministry is called Preserving Bible Times. It's out of Gaithersburg, Maryland. And he did a series on the parable of the Good Samaritan, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago or so, maybe four, I don't know. And I'm going to be taking bits and pieces from that as well, and lots of other commentaries that I've read on it, but I'm using Doug's outline, so I give credit there. Before I get into reading the parable, I want to talk, you know, how I like to set it up a little bit. And that's what Preserving Bible Times is about. It's about getting into the context. What was society like? What was the world like? What was going on? What were some of the dynamics to make the scriptures come alive in a way where we can immerse ourselves in their culture so we can understand what they understood? You know, what did the people, when they heard this parable of the Good Samaritan, what were they thinking in their culture? And then we can figure out how to apply it to our own. We've talked about some of these things before, so I'll be very brief. But who were the Pharisees? Well, what I hadn't talked about, and I really wasn't aware so much, but after Alexander the Great had conquered pretty much the whole known Western world and even over into Asia, the process of what we call Hellenization began everywhere, where Greek culture, Greek ideas, Greek ways of thinking, all that type of, were growing in a rapid way all over the earth, especially around Europe and the Middle East, in the areas that he had conquered. And among Jews, and you've read things about the Maccabees and certain historical things there, among the Jews there was a bit of a battle. You know, do we become Greek? Do we stay with our culture the way it was? How do we combine these things? The birth of the Pharisees, you might say, was from a group of people, a group of leaders, who decided, you know, our young people are beginning to become more like Greeks than like Jews. This isn't good. We need to teach them the law. We need to teach them our culture, our history. We need to show them how to live and how we've always lived. And this group of people became those that we know as Pharisees in the Gospels. And so they're, you know, a couple hundred years beginning before the time of Jesus. And their motives were good, to try to preserve the value that's perceived in the minds of the average Jew, especially the Jewish young people, is how important it was to follow God's law, follow his principles. Now, in doing that, what inevitably happens, and it happens in our day today, when you try to say what we do is good and how we have been taught is good, you can become, and this is what happened to the Pharisees and those who follow them, you can become judgmental of everybody else. If we're good, they're bad. And you can begin to draw lines and have boxes. And this is the way my brain works. I love boxes. I got a grandson now that's like that. A couple of grandsons, actually, that are a bit like that. I want to categorize everything. That's just the way my brain works. Well, the Pharisees did that. So if we're good and we're doing the right thing, these people are bad, they're doing the wrong thing. God doesn't love them or doesn't love them as much. And it can grow to be a judgmental thing, which it wasn't at first, other than to say, we don't want to adopt Greek culture. You could say that's judgmental, but maybe not. You're just saying, look, this is a culture we don't want to adopt. But then when you start thinking to yourself, well, God doesn't love these people. God doesn't care for them because they're not like us. Then you start getting into a frame of mind that when you read the Gospels, you find out Jesus wasn't like that, and he didn't want to be that way. And you get into calling other people sinners. You notice that in the Bible, in the Gospels. I forget. I didn't write down where it was. But, you know, there's a comment that, well, we know that God doesn't hear sinners. Well, we're all sinners, but that doesn't mean that. It meant, you know, you had your good Jews that followed the law, and everybody else, they were sinners. It was a technical term for everybody that's not like us. God doesn't hear their prayers. He only hears our prayers. So it got to be very separatist in a way. And I think most of us would say that's not a good thing, but that's just the way it was. And that's the way this person who's asking Jesus this question is a Pharisee. And that's the way he's been brought up, and that's the way he's been taught. And it's a lot of us and them. Us and them. And Jesus comes along, he's got a different message. So he was butting heads with the Pharisees all throughout the Gospels. There's other people that are defective. They're defective because they're Gentiles. They're defective because, well, Hugh brought it up in his opening prayer. The woman, you know, that Jesus sat down with that woman, and that was at a well in Samaria. She was a Samaritan. And, you know, these were people that were not like us and that God doesn't like, or God doesn't like as much. So there's a lot of that kind of attitude in this world that Jesus lived in. I told you before that really pious Jews would sometimes, when they had to come from Galilee, I didn't bring a map, but Galilee's up in the north and Judea's down where Jerusalem is in the south. So you had Jews that lived up in Galilee. They needed to come down to Jerusalem for the feast days. And I've told you before that from your perspective, they'd go east down to the Jordan Valley, come down in the Jordan Valley, and then come back up through Jericho to Jerusalem. Klein Snodgrass says there's very little evidence that too many of them did that. So I've read elsewhere where they did it, but I don't know where the evidence is. Klein says there's not much evidence of that, so I'll just say that right now. Apparently there was some of that. Jesus himself didn't bother with that, it doesn't seem like. He went right through, and many did. And there were rules and laws on how to interact with the Samaritans. So it wasn't that they wouldn't have anything to do with them, but there was an attitude. And you see that in the Gospels. Let's look at Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9. You say, is he ever going to get to the parable? Well, sometime I will. But we need to talk about why the parable means what it does. We need to look at the background here. Now, in Matthew chapter 9, I need to say something else first. What you get, and I've experienced this personally in my own life, so I can vouch for this. But I'm reading this, but I can say, you know, I've experienced this myself. You probably have as well. When we allow ourselves as human beings to get into a judgmental mindset that God's with us and God's not with them, what godly quality goes missing relatively quickly? And you probably have a lot of answers to this. Humility, that's one. That's not the one I'm after, but that's true. Love and humility. I'm looking for something more specific. Those are both true. They came to my mind right away, love. What else do we tend not to be to these others?
Tolerant
or?
Forgiving.
Okay. I'm looking for the word merciful. Same thing. It all ties together. Mercy's missing. Now, I'm not going to ask for show of hands. I'll just raise mine. I've been that way. I'm probably still that way some. I don't want to be as much as I was. But, you know, I was taught or absorbed it or whatever, and it was part of my nature anyway because we're human, to not be merciful to people that are different. I have my own reasons for why these people don't deserve mercy. But we read about Jesus, and he was different. And he was always being criticized because he was different. Matthew chapter 9, what verse do I want to start in? Verse 10, I think. It came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in the house, when he called Matthew. Behold, many publicans or tax collectors and sinners came down and sat with him and his disciples. Again, that word sinners, that means people that were not on the inside. They weren't the good Pharisees Sadducees really weren't. They were the elite. So the good Pharisees, the good law-abiding, God's law-abiding, whatever. So you had other people. They were sinners. Get back here. He sat down and eat with him as the disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, why does your master eat with tax collectors and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, he said to them, they that are whole, if you're well, you don't need a physician. It's the people that are sick that need the physician. But go and learn what it means. I will have mercy and not sacrifice. For I am not come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance. And that's repeated in Matthew 12 as well. Find out what it means. You know, that's a quote from, where is it? Hosea? I forget. It's from the Old Testament. You know, I would have mercy, not sacrifice. I have to say, in my background, in my history, in the way I think, I was conditioned, and I tend to be I tell the people that I work for that when it comes to estimating, I'm a stick counter. You know, I count sticks. That's how I estimate how much things cost. But that's the way, you know, my mind tends to be detailed like that. So I could be very detailed about why I'm not merciful to this individual or that individual. So I don't, that's just part of the way I am or the way I was, hopefully not as much as I was. But Jesus was different. Jesus was merciful. He said, you know, it's the sick people that need a doctor, not the people that are already well. So he was criticized for that continually throughout the Gospels because he was merciful. And he's merciful to the people that everybody else looked down on. Mercy was somewhat missing. If you weren't on the inside, we can be merciful to our own, but not to them. God doesn't care for them. But actually, they had the prophets, you know, their own Hebrew prophets there in the Old Testament that said that God was concerned for everybody. But they didn't get it yet. And I'm not trying to be critical. They just didn't get it yet. In Luke chapter 4, to get back to the book of Luke, Luke tends to be, I think, more chronological than some than the other Gospels, more detail to the chronology, but whether it's perfect or not, I don't know in that sense. But I would assume that this incident in Luke 4 happened before the one who we're reading about later in Luke 10. In Luke 4, in verse 16, it says, he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath and stood to read. Now, he didn't just read whatever. You know, there was a lectionary. There was certain verses were read on certain weeks. And he was given a scroll, the scroll of Isaiah. And he opened it and found the place where it was written. This is Isaiah, 61? The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. I'm reading from the King James. Because it has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, he has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. And then he sat down, and then he sat down and commented and said, you know, you're seeing this with your own eyes right now being fulfilled. They weren't real thrilled with that. But if you look at the words that are used there, Jesus is not talking about the people that have everything going for them, that he's going to come and serve. He's quoting, of course, he's reading from Isaiah, but what's Isaiah talking about? Well, he's talking about the poor, the brokenhearted, the captives, the blind, the bruised, and so on. These are the people that Jesus was going to focus on. He got criticized for doing that all along. So, Jesus' ministry involved mercy, and mercy for those that weren't on the inside, weren't on the, you know, they weren't in the inner circle, the in crowd, not at all. And he said, you know, this is happening in your hearing right now. You're seeing the fulfillment of this. So Jesus' ministry, the focus of his ministry, was not what the people expected, and certainly not what the people expected from a Messiah. And they didn't really get it, of course. It's not their fault. They didn't understand. Back to Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. The certain lawyer stood up, right? Tempted him. What should I do to inherit eternal life? What? And Jesus said, it's interesting this the way Luke writes it here. He said, what is written in your law or in the law? How do you read it? And then he answered. And the man gave the right answer. What's interesting here is the style of teaching. And it's a style that works very well. I'm not real good at it. Maybe some of you are better. But it's a style that somebody asks a question, you answer them with a question. You try to get them to flesh out the answer. Jesus didn't have to tell him what was written in the law. This guy was a quote-unquote lawyer in the King James. It means he understood the law, had large portions of it memorized. And when Jesus said, how do you read the law? He gave the right answer. So the question came to be one of not what's in the law, because everybody knew that, at least these kinds of people, the Pharisees, they knew what was in the law. They could quote it. Jesus' question is, well, how do you read it? In other words, what does it mean? How do you apply what it says to your life? That's the way Jesus answered the question. He answered a question with a question. Then there's some value in that. But the answer was, well, what does it mean? We know what it says. What's it mean? Because that's where Jesus differed. You know, all the time he was going through some of these things in his series of sermons, you know, where Jesus would say, you've heard it said, but I say. Well, they were not arguing about what it said. They're arguing about how to look at it. They weren't arguing, but I mean, the dispute was about how do you look at these things. And of course, we've said before, you've got to read the whole book. You can't really cherry pick, take something out of context and say that's, you know, it means what it appears to mean just right there and ignore everything else. Some things have a specific context as well. Well, anyway, I think I know I can learn from this style. I can learn to be more interactive. I like to be interactive, but need to ask more questions to get people thinking rather than just being didactic and telling people. So when the person here, the lawyer, the Pharisee, rightly answers, he says, love God with all, you know, quoting Deuteronomy 6 and quoting Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself, love God with all your heart. He said, you've answered right. Jesus said, you've answered right. Do this and you shall live. And I think I'm going to talk about this. I won't talk about it later. I'll talk about it now. I don't know when I had it in the notes. But, you know, there's among some Protestant organizations, there's a real fear of implying or saying in any kind of a way that you have to do anything. You know, and there's people that, I'll give credit to Klein. He's done the research here, and he says, you know, Jesus didn't have a problem with saying, "Do this, and you shall live." And he acknowledges something that many of you know. You've probably learned on your own or study that in the culture of Jesus' time, the Jewish culture, it wasn't a culture of where they had a list of beliefs. It was what you did, is how you behaved, how you acted. We're more of Greek thinking, and we want to have a list. That's the way my brain works. I want to have a list. But they weren't like that. It was more like, what do you do? Everybody knew what the list was. They knew what the law said. But what did you do? How did you practice it? And Jesus here, from the way it reads, he didn't have a problem with somebody asking, what should I do to have eternal life? And Jesus said, do this and you'll live. He didn't say, you don't have to do anything. You just believe on me. Forget the doing part. And a lot of modern-day Christians in the 21st century have a problem with that. They really have a problem with that because it's supposed to be only belief. You don't have to do anything. And Jesus said, no, do this. It's actually do. It's an action verb there. And he wasn't trying to hide the fact that there are things that you need to do. So that's a little side point there. We said we haven't gotten to the parable yet. Now, before we go any further, the next thing I want to do, and that's why I have the screen set up, is I want to talk about, let you see the terrain. And Brad, you probably shouldn't record this because I'm going to have something, it's copyrighted, and there's going to be some talking. So you get an idea of how remote, even today, 2,000 years later, this area is that Jesus chose for his story about this individual that we know as the Good Samaritan. A very, very remote place, a place that was known for having thieves along the road. The first time I gave this talk was in Thailand. There was actually somebody in the audience, a Brit, who had walked that road, had been on that road. Well, I don't know if he walked it, but he'd been down the road and was familiar with the surroundings. And he verified, you know, everything that's in that video there. So this is where it was. This is the road. And the road went from Jerusalem up at, you know, a couple thousand feet down to Jericho, which was almost 1,000 feet below sea level, 4,000 foot drop. And this is where the parable took place, or where the story is to have taken place. So, let's see. Sorry, I'm going to back up. I don't want to read. So I don't want to get ahead of myself and read the scriptures before my notes. So, Jesus had previously in his ministry talked about the poor. You know, blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are, you know, these are people that are powerless in some way. It wasn't blessed are the Sadducees who are the rich and fat people in, metaphorically speaking, in Israel. It wasn't blessed are the Pharisees that studied the law to no end. It wasn't blessed are the zealots who want to kill the Romans so that they can take over. You know, it wasn't blessed. It was meek. It was the poor in spirit. And in fact, you know, the real kicker was you have to be, if your righteousness does not exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, there's no way you're going to be in the kingdom. Well, if you were in that culture, who were the people who were seen as the ultimate in being godly, the ultimate in understanding what God wanted from people? It was the Pharisees. They were the ones that you looked up to. And Jesus said, you know, if you're not better than them, you're not even going to be there. Whoa. You see, he was always challenging people, always challenging the notions that they had of the way things were and the way God looked at it. Now, just one more thing before we actually get into the parable. That is, who are these Samaritans? You know the history. You know, Israel was conquered by the Assyrians, and some of them were taken into captivity. Other people were brought in. The Assyrians, in order to make sure that the local people didn't rebel, they took the local people away and brought in replacements, especially the smart ones. So the Samaritans were, at least the way the Jews looked at it, these people that were some Israelite maybe, but not quite. They were, you know, it was a little pollution going on there. They had their own temple on Mount Gerizim, so they were looked down on by the Jews. There was, you know, a definite idea of that these people are not God's people, right? And most of the time they would try to avoid contact unless they had to do it for business or something. And in fact, when we look back at John 4, with where Hugh had mentioned this incident with the woman, notice remember what the woman said? You don't have to turn there necessarily. In John 4. Verses 3 and 4, I think I'm going to read. We'll start there. He left Judea and departed again to Galilee. So he's going from Jerusalem back home, and in order to do that, he went through Samaria, because Samaria was in between. And he didn't bother going all the way around and down the Jordan, you know, down the 4,000 feet to the road that's in the Jordan Valley, and they go up to Galilee that way. He didn't do that. And he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the parcel of ground where Jacob gave to his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. And Jesus was wearied with his journey. He sat at the well, and it was about the sixth hour. And there came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said, "Give me a drink." And his disciples had gone to the city to buy food. And the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it you, being a Jew, ask a drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." So there's the background. In general, as much as they could avoid it, the Jews didn't have anything to do with the Samaritans. At least wouldn't initiate contact unless you had to. And Jesus didn't have to, but he did. And he had a conversation, which we won't read now. In Luke chapter 8, back to Luke. Again, this is probably before Luke 10. At least Luke puts it there. Luke chapter 8, in verse 26, I think it is. It says, they arrived at the country of the Gadarenes, which is over against Galilee. Now, this was a place on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And it was a place where Jews didn't go because these were non-Jews. And Jesus went over there. And if you read the story, I don't know, it's not here, maybe it's in another, it might have been another gospel. You know, it doesn't even say that the disciples got out of the boat. It says Jesus did, but it didn't say they did. And I don't know, I'm kind of thinking they stayed in the boat. You know, but Jesus got out. And Jesus interacted with this individual who had demons. And he didn't mind being, you know, touched by people that had demons, or touched by a leper, or he would touch a leper. He did things that were out of the ordinary for a Jew, that Jews wouldn't do for whatever the reasons. Jesus did it. So the disciples had their ideas. You know, when they went through, I probably didn't write it down. But you're familiar with the story where John... is it James and John? There's another case where Jesus is going to pass through Samaria on his way to Jerusalem. He's up in Galilee. He's going to go to Jerusalem. He's going to go, and he wants to stay in this village. And the people in the village are not very hospitable because they know he's not staying there. They know he's passing through going to Jerusalem, so they didn't want him to stay there. And what did James and John say? Remember? How about some fire from heaven? You know, like Elijah. Woo. Now, is that, do you think, I don't know, but do you think they just said that of everybody that they didn't like? Or is it, you know, I think it's probably reserved more for Samaritans, you know, and other, you know, people that were on the outside. It's like, I think they just didn't want them to stay there. It doesn't mean we have to kill them. And Jesus said, you know, you don't know what spirit you're of. But just that's the background. That just gives you an idea. Even these people that are sitting at the feet of Jesus every day didn't get it. These Samaritans, they're you know, they might as well get burned up. They're of no use unless we could stay in their village. And the gospel says they went to another village. No big deal. So even the disciples needed to get some of these ideas out of their heads. Okay, let's read the parable finally. Back in Luke 10. It says, certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. So he's going downhill. You saw the pictures there. He's going down that road. And he fell among thieves who had plenty of places to hide. They stripped him of his raiment, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. And by chance there came down a certain priest that way, and when he saw him, he passed by the other side. I'm going to stop. Well, no, I'll read the whole thing, make sure we get it all. And likewise a Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked on him and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was and saw him and had compassion on him. And he went to him and he bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. He set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn, took care of him. And on the morrow when he departed, he took out two pence and gave them to the host and said to him, take care of him. Whatever you spend more than this, I'll pay when I come back. And Jesus asked, which of these three think you was the neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? The Pharisee said, he that showed mercy on him. You notice, is there anything interesting about that answer? Anybody catch it?
He didn't say Samaritan.
He couldn't bring himself to say the Samaritan. The guy who was nice. All right. And then Jesus said, go and do likewise. Do. Another action verb. Not just believe, but do. Okay, we don't know anything about the person who fell among the thieves, other than it was a dangerous area. It was known to be rife with thieves along the road. Normally, people traveled in groups just for protection. This guy apparently, you know, it's a story, but he was traveling on his own. And we don't know anything about him except he was beat up, left for dead. His clothes were gone, and he's on the side of the road. And you saw the road. Those that have been on the road say that you can see for a long distance on the road usually. I guess there's time, you know, it must follow the ridge so it doesn't have to do the switchbacks too often. I've never been on the road, but they say for most of the road you can see far ahead. Now, first we have a priest. Now, everybody remember from your Old Testament studies, the priests were who? They were sons of?
Levi.
They were Levites, but they were sons of?
Aaron.
Only the priests were only from the from Aaron's four sons. And then Levites, so anybody, the whole tribe of the Levites, and they were the people who did what? The grunt work. I mean, they were the workers in the temple and in the whole cultic system of Israel. They were the ones who did the heavy lifting. The priests were the ones who handled the rituals. So you had your priests and your Levites. And in terms of the structural hierarchy, the priests were up here, Levites were a little bit below. You could have poor Levites. Probably didn't have too many poor priests. Why? Because the tithe went there. And it took care of them. So the first one to come along in the story is a priest. Why would the priest, I mean, we don't know, it doesn't say. Why would the priest perhaps, you know, say, I can't get involved, I need to go to the other side?
They weren't allowed to touch dead bodies. They'd be unclean, couldn't perform their duties.
Couldn't perform their duties. What do we know, though, and of course the way Jesus set it up, it's a story again, but what do we know about this priest because he was going, I'm sorry, I need to read, did I say that? I need to read something here. Well, okay. Jesus says in verse 31, there came a certain priest that way. If you take that to be literally, that he was going in the same direction, okay, what does that tell us about the priest?
He wasn't going to do any work.
He was on his way home. Now, the priest had, remember, there were 24 courses of priests that went and served at the temple a week at a time. Each of them took a day, and then the whole group, there's 1/24th of them, they'd go up, a certain clan of them would go up for a week, and then on the Sabbath they would all serve during the week that a certain group of them would serve. At the end of the week, they could go another, or after the Sabbath, they'd go, another group would come in. A lot of the priests lived in Jericho because it was only 17 miles. Now, it was a hard 17 miles, but it was, out of town, and there were a lot of priests that lived there, apparently, from what people say. And the implication here is that he was going in the same direction, therefore he was done with his duties, but he had certain duties back home too. Now, again, Snodgrass goes into it a little more detail, and I've seen it elsewhere also. And that, we can make the excuse, and the priest could have made the excuse, I can't touch a dead body because then I'm unclean, and it'd take a week for me to get clean again. But a lot of Jesus' confrontation with the people in Israel during his time had to do with not the law says this or the law says this, but how do we interpret the priorities? Okay, does that make sense? When is an ox in a ditch? And so Jesus was continually, in a sense, questioning. Well, how do you read it? So there were, in Jewish law at the time, in the interpretation of the Torah, there was a very clear direction on what to do if there was life in danger, or what to do in terms of court. And priests were required to bury a neglected corpse, even though that made them unclean. Okay. Now, in this case, we don't know that the priest knew whether the man was alive or dead. He didn't bother to get close enough to find out. Okay. So his motivation in any sense was somewhat from a legalistic point of view, I can't get involved in a mess, mess up things. But it wasn't the only way of interpreting the law, and Snodgrass has the quotes from the different Jewish sources that there were alternative opinions that, yes, you should take care of this or you should take care of that, even though it might make you unclean. Jesus let lepers touch him, right? Or he touched leper. He did things that other people didn't do. Because the law didn't say you can't do this. This is you're unclean. I mean, you can't go to the temple right after that. You got to go through the procedure. You might have to do a sacrifice, cost some money. There might be expense involved. But it doesn't say you can't care for a sick person or you can't bury a corpse. It's just, as Hugh says, pointed out, there's the, it brings on its own obligations if you were to do it. But for whatever reason, we don't know what it was. Again, it's a made-up story. The priest decided not to get involved and crossed to the other side. And you can make the argument that it was for ritual defilement issues. You can also make the argument that it wasn't. We just don't know. He just chose not to. And from the way it reads, the priest didn't even get close enough to find out if the man was alive or dead. All right, I'm not going to read the details, but just... trust me, we can look in the book if you want, but Snodgrass points out and has the quotes to show that it wasn't in any way against the law for the priest to get involved or to touch. It just would have made it inconvenient. Next comes the Levite. Doesn't say how close the Levite did. The Levite see the other guy or whatever? Doesn't say. The priest probably, if you read Kenneth Bailey, another guy that I like to read about the parables, priests were fairly well off. He probably had his own donkey. Levite, probably not. I mean, again, it's a made-up story, but the point is that the person hearing the story would think the priest is well off, he's got a donkey. Levite's probably walking. And the Levite comes along next. Levite might have seen that the priest went to the other side. But it does say something different here. You notice when we read through it, it says the Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked and then passed by on the other side. So at least he got close enough to see what was going on, maybe see that the guy was breathing, whatever, but then he still chose not to get involved. He had some of the same ritualistic concerns, perhaps. We don't know. It doesn't say, and it's not important really in the story why these two individuals decided not to get involved. The point is they didn't get involved. There was a rule. There was a rule, not biblical. They had a rule, the 4-cubit rule or something like that, that you couldn't get within, that'd be 6 feet for us, couldn't get within 6 feet. Is that of a dead? I don't remember. It might be of a corpse. It wasn't just you couldn't touch, you couldn't get within 6 feet. So that might explain why the priest is said to have gone to the other side, and then finally even the Levite. So it's not even a matter of touching, of course, but they put a hedge around many of the laws to make sure you never broke a law. If you didn't get within 6 feet, you certainly weren't going to touch it, right? If it's possible, the Levite could have even seen the priest avoid and was just following his example. We don't know. We don't know what we can only guess as to what people would imagine when they heard it in this case. But what happens next? If you were hearing this story, and a priest came along, and Jesus is making this story. He says, first it was a priest, and then it was a Levite. You know there's somebody else coming, right? You realize this story's going to have a conclusion, and it hasn't concluded yet. Who would you expect would come next? Get yourself in their sandals. Who would come next?
A normal person, a Jew.
A regular Jew? A regular Joe? A regular Yochanan? A Jewish person. So that would make sense. This is two Jews having a conversation about what to do when, who's my neighbor? And we've got a priest, we've got a highfalutin Jew, we got a Levite who's a semi-highfalutin Jew. Who's going to be next? It's just logical that the next person is going to be a regular Jew that doesn't have position or status. But Jesus said, but a certain Samaritan. Whoa. Can you imagine this Pharisee, his reaction? He wasn't expecting that. Guarantee you, he wasn't expecting that. Jesus is hitting him with a broadside here. Why did Jesus hit him with a broadside? Because this Pharisee knew. He might have been arguing about who his neighbor was. And maybe he wasn't quite sure. But what was he sure of? This Samaritan wasn't his neighbor. He's not even in the discussion. Maybe some of the sinners among the Jews, maybe those who, But the Pharisee didn't see this coming. He had no idea that Jesus was going to come out of left field with this one. Say the next one's a Samaritan. Not only that, but he's a good Samaritan, as we say in English and have the expression. And that's not just my idea. A lot of commentaries point that out. Doug Greenwald says, you've got to be kidding. No one listening to Jesus in that day would have ever imagined that the next person to arrive on the scene was a Samaritan. Once again, we see how imaginative Jesus is in creating stories to drive home memorable paradigm-changing themes. It was also courageous for Jesus to tell such a shocking and confrontational story to his Jewish audience. So there was animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans, and Josephus points out, and I hadn't learned this before I was working on this sermon, that a few years prior, within everybody's memory, but it might have been a decade or two, I don't remember exactly, a Samaritan had come into the temple area and spread bones around, to desecrate it. So they had, it's kind of like the Palestinians and the Jews or in Ireland, whatever. You got these people with these long festering wounds, and this the one between the Jews and the Samaritans had festered for a long time, but it had been recently inflamed within the memory of all the people that were hearing Jesus by this Samaritan that came up and desecrated the temple or tried to. I've never heard it preached this way, but in America, we have racial issues. We have attitudes of whites against blacks. We have people against whites and blacks against Hispanics that have come and taken jobs. We have lots of racial tension and animosity in our own country. And Jesus could just as easily have given this parable now And he wouldn't have said Samaritan. He could have said black, or he could have said Mexican, or he could have said, you know, you name it, whoever were the prejudices against. So we need to bring this up and modernize it a little bit and realize, you know, this applies to us too. All right. What did the Samaritan didn't just come and look, but he went to him, bound up his wounds. Now it says he was stripped naked, so maybe the guy had to take his own clothes and make bandages. I don't know. Set him on his own beast. Now maybe this Samaritan was a businessman. He had burdens on several beasts, but he had his own personal one that he was riding. Doesn't say, but it says his own beast, as if he had a personal one he was riding on besides maybe others. But he puts the wounded man on his own beast, and then he's walking. He was rich enough he didn't have to walk, but now he's walking and carrying. You know, so this is the image that Jesus is painting. That these other two individuals who are Jewish leaders ignored this guy, and that the Samaritan comes along and he not only notices and has compassion, but then he starts fixing the guy up as much as what he can with what he's got. And then he takes him to the inn. Now, inn is not like a hotel or anything. It's more like a stone protection from wild animals or something. It's very rudimentary. But he takes him there, and there's somebody that's managing it. And he stays with him over the night. So it's not just rescue, you could say. That's Doug Greenwald's term. But it's restoration. Try to make the guy better. That's what Jesus does, right? He rescues people from sin, and then he... actually, rather than me say it, that's Romans chapter 5 and verse 10 says it. It's worth reading. Romans 5:10. For if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more being reconciled will be saved by his life. It's a two-step process. Reconciliation or saving or rescue and then life, you know. And the Samaritan was concerned about both of those. And he wasn't going to leave. And he left a lot of money. Now, some people estimate that the cost of a caravansary, which is what that place would have been called, was maybe a 12th of a denarii a day. So leaving 2 denarii would pay for almost a month's worth of stay. And so he was generous. He was generous. And he cared. All right. I'm almost here to the end. So Jesus asked, well, which of these three men was neighbor to him that fell among the thieves? Well, he that showed mercy on him. So the Samaritan was the neighbor. Now, we can leave it at that. But what was the point that Jesus was making to this Pharisee? Was he trying to make the point to the Pharisee that the Samaritan was the neighbor to the injured man? Or was there more to it? What goes along with that? The Samaritan was that guy's neighbor because he helped him. And that's a point. That's a point of the parable. It's a good point. But what else is he saying? God's not a respecter of persons. That's the real big, broad lesson there, sure. What's he saying specifically about to the Pharisee about the Samaritans?
Shouldn't judge anybody.
Yeah, I mean, they are your neighbor.
Yeah.
He's saying, yes, the Samaritan was a neighbor to the person who was injured. But the bigger picture, you know, on the way to Sue's biggest picture there, is that those people living in Samaria are your neighbors. You know, and the bigger picture, as Sue points, is that, you know, we as human beings don't have the right to draw lines and say, here's where my neighborliness ends, and these people are on the other side of that line. That's the lesson of the parable. Who are we to decide who our neighbors are in this sense, in the spiritual sense? And the man, you know, had trouble with that. He couldn't even say the word Samaritan. But Jesus said, yeah. It's the one who had mercy. Go and do likewise. Do the same thing. You read the prophets. You read Jesus in the Gospels. You read the whole New Testament. You realize God's plan from the beginning was to include all of mankind and didn't want us as human beings building walls to between us and other parts of humanity and saying something like God doesn't care for those people or God doesn't care for those people, he only cares for us. It's not our prerogative to do that. God does not permit us to make our own definitions for who our neighbor is, who our neighbors are. So which of these three do you think was the neighbor to him that fell among the thieves? And, you know, the answer is obviously he that showed mercy on him. And Jesus' reply to that man is the same as the reply that he has to us today, and that is, go and do the same.